Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And it's time for the Disciplined Investor Podcast episode number 244. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and whatever holiday that you're celebrating these days, I want to wish you and your family the best, the warmest, and a wonderful, wonderful time. It is the end of 2011. I just got back from a very short vacation down to Curacao, did some great night diving, spent some time with the family, the kids, saw some octopus and lionfish, and had some good food. And I must tell you, the prices these days are absolutely frightening in terms of how they've gone up. Over the last number of years, I've seen the Caribbean prices just kind of inch up, and then boom. This year, it was for a small beer, it was $5.50 for an 8-ounce now, not even a 12-ounce. And for drinks, it was $4, like, Diet Cokes or iced tea. Meals were $30 a piece, and I said, wow, this has gotten a bit out of hand. But that's what we're seeing around the world, and we know what's going on. Food prices have gone up, although recently dropped down pretty significantly, but still not reflective in the end product that we're seeing in some of the areas around the world. But I thought what we'd do now is we'd spend some time. It's one of those times of years that you want to reflect, you want to look back, you want to see what happened so you can make proper judgments and projections and really set up the next go-round, if you will, the next movement, the next cycle. So here we are, 2011. Markets have been through a, 20-25% move on the U.S. from the S&P. The Russell was down as much as 20-something percent this year and then popped back, still negative for the year. S&P is just slightly positive for the year. Dow is up about 6%. But the rest of the world looks absolutely miserable. Right? We're seeing that in China, the Shenzhen keeps on moving lower, down about 35% this year. We're seeing Japan, just their economy still contracting. Europe, we've talked about ad nauseum. But I thought what we'd do is we'd spend a little time going back to some of the, I thought, the highlights of the year and some of our guests that were on the podcast. And again, a great time of year to do this where we can look back to what was being said, what really happened, and how it all played out, and what changed in between. What made the difference between going from, let's say, a collapse of a bank, theoretically, to its survival? What made from stocks moving down to all of a sudden being level, or vice versa? What happened from where we saw Research in Motion go from a high to a low? And you know, what is it that the catalyst was, and what changed in the overall ideas of investors and economists, analysts, et cetera? I think it's really important to look at that, where there was something that was the changing factor in all this and how we can learn from it, because that's what it's all about. Whether you've done well this year or last year or you've done poorly, you have to learn from it and grow, because every market is different. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, it happened last year that the markets were up and it'll be down. Or you can't say it's been up and so it's going to be up. You can't say, well, this has been a great stock over the last 3 years, so therefore it's going to be a great one moving forward. And I can tell you, it's been a very, very tough year for a lot of people. It's been a very tough year for us in terms of our trading. And, I talk to a lot of colleagues, and basically this is what they say. They tell me that the bulls aren't happy and the bears aren't happy. No one is happy, because if you look at the performance of those that thought the economy was going to do very well in the U.S. and abroad, or those that thought it was going to collapse, nobody's really happy, because governments have come in at every juncture, almost at the perfect time, and all of a sudden pushed in a lot of liquidity, or at the same time, they let things go a little bit too far when they should have probably done something. So what happened is the trends shifted so incredibly quickly, so fast, so on a dime, that it made for any kind of movement almost, it didn't make them anybody happy. If you were long when the markets were moving up higher and all of a sudden it took this big 7 or 8 or 10% correction, you were miserable. And, you know, maybe you think about buying on the bottom. That would have been great. But at the same time, a lot of people who are shorting at the right time and hedging really got blown out as well. So it's really a tale of many different markets this year. It's a situation where there was a lot of uncertainty that continued on. And what I thought we'd do is we start off with some of the discussion with some of our guests throughout the year. And what I thought, you know, we'd go back and listen to some of the people, what they said, what our conversations were. And again, this time of year, it's a great time to do it. So first up, we're going to talk and bring back Barry Ritholtz. Back in January of 2011, we were talking about economics. We were talking about what is happening around the world. What are the most logical means to stimulate? And one of the things that, you know, that does work and some of the things that don't work. So take a listen. In Europe, they're really concerned about the inflation rate picking up and their inflation rate is showing up. But meanwhile, they're on austerity. It's a little bit weird.
You know, austerity is, you're raising two or three issues. And I think a lot of people get the underlying issues wrong. First, when we talk about austerity, you have to wonder, why are people talking about austerity? Keynes actually got most of this right. I know a lot of right-wing guys like to bash Keynes, but it's clear that Milton Friedman got a lot of the deregulation stuff wrong, and people misunderstand what Keynes said. They actually get Keynes wrong. What Keynes said is, during a recession, when the private sector stops spending, if the government steps in and replaces that, you'll modify the depths of the economic cycle and have a shorter, shallower recession. Now, Keynes also said, once the economy recovers, the government should step out of the way and let the private sector do what they're going to do. But in the reality is that's a difficult process. It's intellectually challenging. It's emotionally difficult. And most politicians have a really hard time with that. So I think the idea behind austerity is exactly ass backwards. When the private sector stops spending, you let the public sector step in and replace it, but only with the caveat that the government should be a counter-cyclical spender, meaning during a recession, they should be cutting taxes and increasing spending and running a deficit. During a boom time, they should be cutting spending and increasing taxes and running a surplus. But again, in order to do that, we would actually have to be mature adults and have an intelligent discussion about spending and taxes. And in the United States, anyway, our politicians are incapable of doing that. If anybody suggests a tax increase, the anti-tax lunatics tear their heads off. You should be cutting taxes during recession. You should be bringing them back to a normal level to pay for services during an expansion. It's very, very simple. Intellectually, it's easy to wrap your head around. No one wants to do that. The government should not be expanding during an expansion. What Bush did that was totally wrong was from 2003 to 2007, you had an expanding economy in large part caused by Greenspan. You had a booming stock market. That's when you raise taxes and cut services because the private sector can afford to step in and replace it. In fact, naturally, the private sector will step in and do that. Hey, they're more efficient than the government. But nobody ever does it that way. Politicians are really, really bad about that. And I think most of the small government anti-tax people misstate Keynes all the time because he pretty much agrees with them in a sophisticated way. Yes, of course, during an expansion, you should have smaller government. And the way you do that is reduce the services and increase the taxes. And you don't run a deficit, you run a surplus. Now, all this brings me to the second point, which is about deficits. And again, we have a core of politicians in D.C. who are hypocritical and you know, disingenuous. On my trading desk, we would say they're full of shit. I don't know if you could say that on a podcast, but...
Beep! Go ahead, next.
There you go. Here's the reality. I see these we call them deficit peacocks, these guys who come out, and they're against spending, they're against the deficit, and you pull up their track record. I actually posted this on the blog the other day. Here, go see how people voted on the Iraq war, on the tax cut, on the health care bill. If you voted in favor of a war of choice in Iraq that was unfunded and cost trillions of dollars, if you voted in favor of an unfunded tax cut, and as long as I mentioned Milton Friedman, let me quote Friedman, who said a tax cut that is not paid for with spending cuts is nothing more than a tax increase on your grandkids. If you voted for the 2001 and 2003 unfunded tax cuts, you are creating a deficit. And lastly, if you voted for that prescription drug entitlement program, you created a deficit. So I look at these guys who are all posturing against the deficit today, and I look at their voting record, and you say, these guys are just partisan jackasses. Why should anybody listen to them? Now, Pete Peterson is an exception. He's a guy who's been railing about the deficit, whether a Democrat or Republican has been in office. He's been on this for 15 years. I give him, you know, full props for that. But 90% of the guys in D.C. who are supposed deficit hawks, they're not. They're peacocks. They're full of crap. And to me, the last thing you want to do when the economy is not stable, when you're not creating jobs, is go to austerity. And don't believe my viewpoint. Just look at England and look at Ireland. They're the poster child for, hey, cut your spending, reduce taxes, do all this stuff, go into austerity. And their economies are all in the crapper, probably as bad as the U.S., if not worse.
But, you know, at the end of the day, Barry, what was really fascinating is that I know that you track all of the economics, and I do as well. And it's kind of like you got to wonder that for example, in England, I mean, their stock market seems to be just all happy-go-lucky. There's no correlation with the economy right now,
never
or at least
been.
The outlook. Yeah,
never
I
has
mean,
been.
The
you know,
yeah.
Frequently the stock market totally decouples from the economy. I mean, look at 99-2000. It went off the rail. Look at 2003-2007. That whole artificial, ultra-low rates, ultra-leverage situation. If the market really was paying attention to what was going on, the market would say, hey, you know, we really shouldn't be screaming higher here because this is a debacle waiting to happen. And yet the market doubled from...
from the late 2002, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
To 2007
or so. 03 to 07, and now from March 2009, here's the joke. Everybody who screams about deficits are so bad for the economy. If you believe the market is telling you what's going on, markets love deficits because it's just additional stimulus spending.
Yeah, it's free
Reagan
money.
Created
exactly.
Huge deficits, huge market rally. Bush
right.
Created huge deficits from 03 to 07, huge market rally. Obama inherited the problem, but he made it worse with his situation, with his stimulus spending and his tax cuts and everything else, huge market rally. The market likes a big deficit because all that deficit spending is stimulative. I know that's
right.
Very counterintuitive and contrary, but the data doesn't lie.
The data doesn't lie. What a great comment that Barry made back in January, and talking about how, you know, austerity versus stimulating maneuvers and deficits are a way to go. And, you know, we've had back and forth both ways. You got to look at, obviously, the difference between the countries these days, I guess, who are involved in austerity or pulling back, emerging markets who are tightening, China who's tightening, versus the U.S. these days, right? I mean, we look at the difference in 2011 between what's happened and in the U.S. and other countries, and the big difference has been the difference in the Fed, the difference in austerity. So I think that's important to take a look at. So next we want to bring up, I think it would be interesting to talk to Andrew Ross Sorkin, or bring back what we had talked about with Andrew Ross Sorkin. Now that was back in May. And if you remember that, Andrew Ross Sorkin had written the book Too Big to Fail. And we talked about the banks. We talked about a lot of things that were still going on around the world. And if Too Big to Fail really is still something that we have to watch for. Andrew Ross Sorkin from the New York Times is here, also a frequent guest and commentator on CNBC, as well as the author of the book Too Big to Fail, and coming very shortly, the movie. I'm sorry, Andrew, by the way, I'm sorry I couldn't play that part that you'd asked me to for the movie.
I know, yeah. I know. You know, Curtis Hanson, the director, was very upset about that. We had to get a whole casting director involved to try to find somebody else. What a mess. But thank you for considering it. I know your agent passed,
yeah.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, so let's talk about a few things. Your book, Too Big to Fail, which was a big piece. It's heavy. It's big. It's because it has a lot of unbelievable insight into the whole banking mess that went on, and you were so embroiled in that. That was like a 24/48/7 kind of thing going on, right? Back then, right?
Oh no, I mean it was. I still think it was the most important moment in our economic history, at least in the past, 50, 60 years, if not in the past century. I mean, I think that September of 2008 is one of those moments that we will be studying for many, many years, and that's why, you know, HBO spent time trying to turn the book into a film.
Yeah. So One of the things I want to ask you is, in the book, you were so detailed and you had so many conversations that were quoted. As I was reading it, I was like, how did you know that? How did you know that stuff?
So I spent about a year interviewing over 200 of the principals for over 500 hours. And I would literally sit with my tape recorder for hours and hours and hours and week. And I would literally ask, the big issue questions, but I'd ask us the little issue questions. What were you eating? What were you doing at the time? What did you say to him? How did he say it back? And I would literally compare the notes and go back and forth between all the participants. And oftentimes, you know, if there were nine, or if there were 10 people in the room, I would talk to 9 of them,
right?
If not 10.
Right.
And so you will really recreate what happened in the room. And to me, you know, in retrospect, it's very easy to sort of decide who's wearing the white hat and who's wearing the black hat and what you think of history. But I think when you can get inside the room, when you get behind the headlines, when you can actually see what people were saying and doing and understand the decisions that were being made and what the opportunities were, meaning, you know, what was on offer. Oftentimes today, I think we look back and we're upset about this or that, but it's often a false choice.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually see what the choices were that were available at the time, I think it may change your perspective.
Yeah. So, you know, I think you were young at the time. You're young now. I think you graduated to, like, college at, like, 13 or something, right?
Not Doogie Howser, but I graduated in 1999.
Okay, well, 1999. So the thing is, you were still, I mean, really, you were young, and you were. I mean, you're a very bright guy. I'm not trying to, you know, butt you up here, but
and you were
able to actually get into that quote unquote club. Right. Obviously, you had credentials behind you with the Times and all that, but you really got some, I mean, just unfettered access to a lot of that. But looking back on now you got the book out. Back on it from this point right now, do you think that there's, you know, kind of this clear sailing that is being told to us by many of the powers that be, or is there the banking system still a mess?
Oh no, not at all. I think that the banking system is a disaster.
Yeah.
I think the too big to fail is too big to fail squared. You know, you look now, top 10 banks control 75% of all banking assets. Think about that.
Yeah.
I think the Dodd-Frank legislation does, I don't want to say next to nothing, but really only gets at the issues around the edges. We still are living with too big to fail.
Yeah.
But I would say that the greatest lesson, actually, this whole project, in a way, is not only that these firms are too big to fail, but that ultimately, because I look at this as a human drama and as a story about people, they're too big to manage.
Mm.
That's the problem, actually.
Right.
When you think of institutions that are this disparate, with this many products, with this many complicated things going on, the idea that one individual who's the CEO is going to somehow understand it, or frankly, a dozen people on the board or even in the management committee is going to really be able to appreciate all these various issues, it's impossible. You know, and there are some great CEOs who came up through the trading side. They understand trading. They don't understand banking. There's some great people who come through the banking side, understand banking. They don't understand trading. You know, there's some people who come in through the wealth management side who are great marketers. I'm not sure they understand banking or trading.
Right.
It's a really complicated thing. You know, I was with, I was up at GE, I don't know when this was, 6-8 months ago, and I was thinking to myself, there are 17 board members at GE, and I know it's not a financial services company, though obviously half of it almost became one with GE Capital. And you think to yourself, this is a company that has 287,000 employees around the world. There's 17 people on the board.
Right.
Do we actually think these 17 people could possibly understand what's happening inside this company?
Well, and top it off,
it's impossible.
What's really interesting is that we always talk about the Fed and all that. We talk about Bernanke. Like, he's the only one doing anything. You know, he's the only, I mean, there's an entire group, more than a group, I mean, teams and teams of people at the Feds and all that, that are providing information. But I want to skip over to something, because back in the day when the banks were doing what they were doing, and we were all about, and still are all about, you know, a confidence game, making sure the stress tests look good and making sure that this guy didn't fail and making sure that, you know, AIG didn't fail because then Goldman would fail, et cetera. That is being played out right now in Europe, don't you think?
Oh, I think it's being played out in Europe. And by the way, you know, forget about the banks. It's being played out in Europe on a much grander scale. You know, when I started this project and this book, I remember going to the editors talking about this phrase, too big to fail. They actually thought it was a bad idea for a title of a book. Now we use that phrase in the context not of financial institutions, but countries in Europe. And that's where this is, you know, and it's a debt problem. It's the same problem in a way. It's sort of the banking problem on steroids. So
yeah.
I look at the European problem as the problem today.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a prelude for what ultimately could be our problem.
Well, what the thing about, I'll mention this last point, I know we have limited time, but one of the things that really troubled me, last week there was actually a clear and I think, concise a summary of what was going on. When we hear, for example, Portugal says we don't need a bailout, and 3 days later they get a bailout. And you know, this whole BS game that goes on, clearly that there was no meeting in, I think it was Luxembourg, to talk about what was going to happen with Greece, and nobody, you know, we're not meeting at this time. They shaped their words just right to throw everybody off the track.
And that goes back to the confidence issue that you're talking about.
Right.
And everybody's so desperate to keep the confidence that they're willing to lie.
Right, which, by the way, is going to end up in no confidence, right?
Well, it's interesting. I get the joke. Having worked on this project, I'll tell you, go back to pre-September 2008 and go back to the idea that people were talking about, you know, Dick Fuld played by Billy Crudup in the movie, Tim Geithner. This is how screwed up my head is.
Right.
But, you know, Dick Fuld went to Tim Geithner and said, please make me a bank holding company. This is back in July. Remember, by the way, right. Of course, this is what we did to Goldman and Morgan Stanley later. If you asked Tim Geithner today, why wouldn't he allow him to do it? Because he thought it would undermine confidence.
Right.
He thought it would raise a red flag. So there's a big problem, which is, you know, we all think we want transparency. We think we do. And as a journalist, by the way, that's all I'm about. And yet, there is a sense that if you tell the public too much, you can actually only make it worse.
I suppose the message from Andrew Ross Sorkin back in May is, you know, when is too much information enough to choke on? Do we really need to have this information constantly hitting us in the face? And do we need to be taking it like drinking from an open fire hydrant? Is that the kind of flow of information that we want and the transparency that we want? Is that good for us? Or maybe we got to slow it down a little bit and take a little bit more time to analyze. I thought that was quite a good comment. Now, we kind of fast forward to June. We had Harry Dent. Now, Harry Dent has gone from boom to bust in terms of his predictions. And in this conversation, we talk about what the future may hold for markets and the world, considering all the things that are going on. We have, as I talked to you about, we have Harry Dent. And Harry is, of course, as you know, the author of The Great Depression Ahead, some of the greatest books that I ever read back in the 1990s, the Roaring 2000s, etc. And I thought we'd get an update of what's going on. Harry, how are you?
Good.
So what's new? I mean, we talked last, and I think we talked about how there was a summertime problem that was brewing. So here we are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been warning for a long time. We knew the government was going to stimulate hard. We didn't think they'd go as far as QE1 and QE2. But, you know, there's going to be a bounce here after the first major crash and meltdown. But that it was going to keep failing because the demographics aren't behind it. Baby boomers are aging. They're moving into their 50s, and people there save more, spend less, and they certainly don't borrow money, and they certainly don't buy houses. In fact, they only tend to downsize from large houses to medium-sized houses, and they eventually end up in a nursing home. So, you know, that's the trend, and we've got unprecedented debt levels. I mean, everybody's focused on the $14 to $15 trillion government debt, and yeah, that's gone up $5 trillion since the crisis started and Obama came in, but that only went from 5 to 10 in the last decade. Private debt went from $20 trillion to $42 trillion, much more massive. And so, it's, you know, this private debt wants to deleverage. Businesses and consumers are too much in debt to borrow more, so the government keeps stimulating. It doesn't get lent. It doesn't get spent. All the money does is goes through the banks back into investment, and it's pumping up a bubble in stocks and commodities and everything else. And so we got a third bubble now that's going to burst in the next year or two. And the economy keeps coming up a little bit and then falling back. So as we're saying, we're taking a lot of Viagra and not much is happening. So, I mean, I've seen polls recently saying, you know, 44 to 48% of people think we're going into a recession or depression in the next year. In other words, they're starting to see that the unprecedented stimulus program, with everything the government's thrown behind it, everything they have, the kitchen sink, every guarantee, quantitative easing, qualitative easing, zero interest rates, the economy's still basically dead, as we've said. So it's a matter now of when do the markets really get it that we're not going to go back to normal,
yeah.
And these deficits are only going to get worse, and these debts are not going to be able to be handled. So that happened in Europe last year in Southern Europe, you know, April, May, and it happened overnight. The bond markets all of a sudden said, hey, we'll lend Greece money at 4.5%. Oops, no, now it's 12%. And, of course, today it's 18% on a 10-year bond and 30% on a 2-year. So once the bond markets, and they're the first to get it, realize that this is an untenable situation, they start penalizing you for further stimulus and irresponsible fiscal policies. Because, you know, the assumption is at first that, okay, if the government stimulates, yeah, it's going to cost some money and raise debt, but the economy will come back and businesses and consumers will do better and tax revenues will rise and the stimulus will be paid for. Well, this is not happening and it's not going to happen. So we're thinking we're getting closer that sometime it'd be later this year, early next year, the stock market's going to top. Probably not going to go a lot higher, but probably going to go a bit higher from here. I think we're about to turn around from this correction. And then between 2012 and 13 or 14, we're going to see another major crash across the board. Real estate, commodities, gold, silver, oil, stocks, international, China, India, U.S., Europe. And it's going to be just like 2008, 2009, nowhere to hide. So if you're not defensive or if you're not betting against these markets, you're going to lose your, as we say, assets.
Yeah, I hear you. Let me just, I'm tightening the noose right now to get it ready because I'm pretty depressed at this point. But, you know, we need, by the way, you mentioned the Viagra kind of methodology where you get a short-term pop, we'll call it, right? And then nothing happens after that. We need those, you ever see the Cialis commercials and it says, you know, if you have one that lasts 4 hours or more, that's what we need. We know those situations,
exactly.
You know? So here's a couple of questions I have for you. So the bond market gets it all of a sudden. Is it that the bond market and maybe even the equity market didn't want to get it? They knew it, but they didn't want to get it. And then on top of that, you had this whole issue of this confidence game that's being played by all the players out there. I mean, have you ever in your career seen more of a parade of Fed and other officials talking about everything and contradicting each other, but at the end of the day, almost the last one that speaks is the one that nixes everybody else's opinion?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is, Andrew. It is, I call it denial. And anything that's unacceptable to a person or a culture or an institution, when, you know, a company that's, you know, in trouble, the first thing is denial. Well, it's not really that bad. Or Wiener, no, it really wasn't my, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or I got hacked. You know, it's always denial. And then the reality eventually sets in. And then as we see today, a guy like Wiener has to step down. I mean, from our point of view, we've never hedged on this. We've never said, like Rubini said recently, well, 1 out of 3 chance, and if that, of a depression or a downturn, and if this, and if the government. No, we're like saying there's no way out of this. We let the bubble go too far. Demographics have turned against the markets and economy. We've been predicting that for 20 years. That's a natural cycle. And so at some point, the markets and everybody in them, like you say, it's all rah, rah, rah. It's not just, it's the Fed, it's the president, but it's all these stockbrokers and financial institutions, and it's the media. CNBC is on there every day like, rah, 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 we do the right thing.
So
like you say, the whole thing, everybody's thinking, if we just keep the confidence up long enough and if people don't panic, we'll get back to normal, and then we can pay off these debts and everything will be okay. There is no getting back to normal with baby boomers aging. There's no getting back to normal with 60-some trillion in unfunded entitlements and $42 trillion in private debt and $15 trillion in government debt and growing. There's no, we have to deal with deleveraging this debt. And the best way to bring cash flow back to baby boomers that are aging and have less income and less spending is to relieve them of their debt. We need to restructure debt in this country that went wild in the last decade. So that's going to be painful at first, like the Great Depression, but it pays big long-term dividends. Imagine, I mean, we got $20 trillion in private debt that could be eliminated to get back in line with real assets and values. We got out of 60-some trillion in entitlements, we could cut at least a third of those just by being common sense and restricting and not letting people have a $500,000 operation when they're going to only live another 6 months. And not, you know, a lot of things you can do, having people retire a little later and you know, means testing some benefits. There's a lot of things could be done, but nobody wants to do it in good times. And the public is concerned about the debt and the deficits. You see that in every poll. But 78% or something like that, more than agree on anything, say don't cut our health care, Medicare, Medicaid. Well, sorry, it's going to be cut. It has to be cut.
Medicare and Medicaid having to be cut, and that's something we've already seen in the recent budget discussions and some of the actual cuts that were made at the end of the month, last month, because of the requirement that was put on by raising the debt ceiling. So Harry Dent nailed that one a bit. I'll see how far it goes. We'll all see how far it goes, and this is going to be a big question, I believe, what's going to happen with that. Then fast forward, let's talk about what happened in July. July, we brought on a good friend of mine, and someone who it's always good to hear from, because you know, Scott O'Neill has the insight, not only as an investor, but as a child of a, I guess we could call him a legend, William O'Neill, and he's been involved with the entire market for all of his life. So if nothing else, by just the placement of where he has been, he gets great viewpoints and great opportunity to understand how experts trade. And we talked with him back then a bit about what's going on with the markets, what's the outlook, when to buy and sell a stock, looking at charts and his daily routine and what he does. Why are the markets so seemingly epileptic at this point? You know, it's like they can't decide whether they want to be in a rally or in a sell-off. It's just so V-like, you know what I'm saying, in either direction?
Yes.
So what's the problem?
Sure. Well, I think number one, above all, you're late in the bull market cycle. You started in March of 2009, and so we're late. And the latter innings of the game typically are much trickier. As we all know, the bigger money is made in the earlier parts of the game. So I've experienced over my career several givebacks late in a cycle because I was still maintaining an aggressive posture when I should have been dialing it back. That's point one.
Mm-hmm.
Point two, we don't really have a solid catalyst. I mean, last cycle, earnings cycle was excellent. And what did the market, how did it respond? You even had the bin Laden thing. And so the market is just having a very tough time. And really, it appears to me like it's in a topping process. Now, you came down very hard since, I think it was May 2nd. I'm just checking right here real quick. Yeah, May 2nd, you peaked on the indexes, and I think it caught a lot of people by surprise because it came down very rapidly. And something else that told me that this was going to be a pretty tough one was four different times in the last, say, 6 weeks, we had a strong up day, and then the immediate next day, we came down very hard.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And those are really bad signs. The market is not healthy. What else?
Those days, that's interesting that you mentioned those days, because a lot of times on those, I think those particular days, I'm visualizing them right now on a chart. Those days were very lightly participated in. In other words, the volume was very light. Now, from the bullish side, they say, well, that doesn't matter. It was still an up day. The bearish side says, you know what? Or the people that are looking at trying to be, I think, objective, say, you know what, you want to see participation by a lot of players and institutions on a good day. But yet, at the same time, when, you know, you see a down day and there wasn't a lot of participation, the bulls take the opposite side, of course. And there was no, the volume has really been drying up, hasn't it?
Yes. You know, Andrew, this is an important little detail. You really do want big volume on up days, especially at critical points in the market. Now, I put a blog out in February that I thought the market was going to starting a topping action, and I put one out in May that was basically pointing out that you have a lot of down days on a pickup in volume and up days on lighter volume, exactly the reverse of what we want. And so you could see signs. If you go back to the charts and look at starting in February, and just day by day on the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, you start to see that it is not acting as healthy. And that's before this last 3-4 weeks where we just came down really hard.
Yeah. I mean, there is that's a good point, because there have been a lot of individual stocks also, and I'll give you an example of one, that have really not been acting quite right. You know, if you think about what a stock in a reasonable uptrend or even in a consolidation should look like, and there's no absolute, but you get these wonky moves. Like, for example, a company called Spreadtrum Communications, you know them, right? SPRD. A few weeks ago, they have put out some great earnings. They're involved in the mobile handset slash parts chip slash market and mobile technology, we'll say. And they looked really good from a lot of different standpoints. And their chart at the time, looked okay. And then we actually bought some of that, and it started looking really kind of wonky. I said, what is going on with it? I just don't like the action. It's like, you know, you'll have a little bit of an up, but then it pulls back towards the end of the day. And even on a good day, it's not getting any traction. And then it's still seemingly to just ease off on a regular basis. I said, you know what? There's something not right with this stock. Is there something not right? Meanwhile, we ended up finding a point that we said, you know what? We're not going to hold it past this point because besides the fact that we have some stop losses set up on this or some levels, it's acting weird. So did you see what happened to that thing in the last couple of days?
Yes, and you bring up a great point. That's why our shop operates on sell rules, and those rules are technical. They are not fundamental because, as you said, the story's good, the numbers look fine, and in fact, it's got all kinds of earnings revisions out there, and yet the stock gets absolutely crushed, and you're either looking at the technicals, i.e. reading a chart, or you're sitting back on the story and you're losing money.
Right.
And this one came undone pretty badly.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that's a good point that you make. I mean, really good point. And I think that if anybody's listening that has ever, you know, over the last number of years heard me talk, you know, you have to have a variety of things, if nothing else, like a system of checks and balances. You know, so often, Scott, you and I talked about this a couple of days ago. We said, you know, a lot of times you'll hear people talk about value. You know, hey, that stock is cheap. That stock is trading at a big discount to its peers. That stock, you know, has a P ratio that's only 7 or whatever it may be, right? And I know you that's like a it's kind of a poisonous thing to your ears, right?
Yes, and I can tell you, I can sum it up exactly why. Because when you hear that, in my opinion, noise, you are buying into a downtrend.
Right.
And stocks trend. We all know that. Well, how do you know where that stock's going to stop? But because it's supposedly a great value and it's really cheap, you're buying into a downtrend. And I could tell you dozens and dozens of stories of people that have blown up their portfolio and or gone bankrupt because of that concept.
In fact, what's really interesting is, let's dial that back a second and think about it. I think it's inherently desirous of a lot of people that they want to buy at or close to the bottom of whatever particular trend it is, right? They want to buy at the bottom. And I can't blame them. I mean, it would be nice, right? Or sell at the top, right? Buy at the bottom, sell at the top. First of all, the probability is very low that that's ever going to happen. Second of all, you can make a ton of money buying it in the middle, if you buy it the right way, without the aggravation, right? And I think I think that the whole idea is that when you fall in love with a position because of the fundamentals, going back to that discussion, because you like the fundamentals and because it's cheap, and it may be according to whatever parameters you use, but then you don't put it on the map, so to speak, put it on the chart to see what's happening, because what the chart is telling you, forget about all the – this is what I think. Scott, you tell me. You forget about all the fancy indicators. You forget about all the fancy patterns, even the patterns that I know that you like. Forget about that. The fact of the matter is the chart is telling you what all the other people think about the stock.
Exactly. It is gauging your supply and demand. It is telling you how many investors are bullish, how many investors are bearish, and what's the net. And that's what the stock market is. It's a supply and demand mechanism. And people forget that. They sit there and they have a favorite stock because there's always lines in the store or, you know, they've got the next best thing. But you have to look at supply and demand.
Yeah, and you can look at examples of that. Blockbuster, great. Yeah, love the videos, all that stuff. But you know what? Well, they were kicked out for a reason. And maybe you could have made a lot of money on Blockbusters in the early days, but then, you know, it rolled over. The other thing that I find interesting, and again, we talked about this the other day, is when someone won't buy a stock, and I'm talking about professionals and TV personalities, because it's too expensive. And that's a loaded point. What do you think about that?
Well, back in 98, we bought a boatload of AOL, and the PE at our buy point was 205. That's what I say to that. And go back to a chart and look at it. The important thing here, this is the classic debate between growth and value. The plain fact is, if you're a basketball coach and you want to build a winning team, you want to go out and you want to recruit Michael Jordan. Now, he's going to be more expensive. Or you could go buy three rookies for the same amount. Now, which way are you going to win more ball games? So we do not look at the P.E. ratio when we're making buy decisions. And I say that out there, and there are people that just look at me like I'm a Martian. And the reality is, we do not look at that because we want to buy the best merchandise possible. And the best merchandise, most of the time, is more expensive.
Right. I hear you on that. And, you know, it's funny.
It's that simple.
And the thing that's funny is that I think the reason why people oftentimes look at that is because that's the only thing that is ever talked about in media is the PE ratio.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything else that you could ever think of?
Well, it's a real disservice, Andrew, because you hear that all the time. And you also hear right now this buying on dips. Well, you buy on a dip, you're buying a downtrend again. And we don't do that. We would right now we have a majority of our assets on the sideline
because
the market is not acting right.
Right. Yeah, the market, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because I know that one of the things that you like to see at your side, and you follow the William O'Neill rules, the things that are talked about in Investor's Business Daily, and then you utilize what you did was, which I think is great, is you created research and a charting tool around it called MarketSmith that allows you then to kind of, I think, put it all together. Would that be a correct statement?
Yeah, MarketSmith, the tool, it is a fabulous tool that we use, and it accesses the O'Neill database, which IBD accesses the same database. The one key is, if someone is a true value investor or whatever type of investor you are, obviously growth too, MarketSmith is an agnostic tool that any approach can be used, because in the end you're trying to find the best companies. Really, the difference between growth and value is where your entry points are. MarketSmith is very valuable and very flexible and easy to use, and a very powerful screener in the tool.
Yeah, the screener is really, I think I agree with that. That's one of the best parts. And the other thing is that the ability to, by the way, something just hit me. I was going to say, let me tell you what I was going to say, and then what something hit me. What I like is where you can just spacebar through and just kind of like go through the charts and kind of let them, you have 50 charts there or 50 stocks you put into a list and just bing, 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 and then change to weekly and bing, bing, bing. And by the way, what a great idea.
That, Andrew, is a huge time saver.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, if I've got several hundred charts to get through and I can hit spacebar and go through and then my eye stops on a particular chart, I'm saving a phenomenal amount of time. It's a very efficient tool because nobody's got time. And yet you got to do your research. You got to come up with your own ideas. I'm sorry, what was the...
Yeah, no, that was great. And then you could flag them. But then it just hit me. I forgot. I totally forgot about this. And I haven't even talked to you about this. That game thing you put together.
That's Chart Arcade.
That's
fun.
Gotta
love it.
Is that fun or what?
Everyone should play it. It's a simulator. It's a flight simulator. Here you are in the battlefield. What are your decisions now? It's a great tool to get into a kind of a routine on how you buy and where the stock's moving pattern wise.
Yes, it basically puts a chart up there and says, okay, here you are. What do you do? Buy, sell, short right now with the information you see in front of you. And you make a decision.
Yeah,
I don't do anything. I buy, whatever, you know.
Exactly. We have probably 500 new unique visitors every day now playing the game.
Just playing the game.
It's catching on.
Yeah, I like it.
It's a pretty cool game, yeah.
I like it because I got to figure out how to actually store my stuff on there, because you can actually go day by day by day by day, or weekly, let's say, and then it tells you what happened and what went on and, why, what the next position is and kind of how it played out. So it can give you, it's one thing looking at a chart and saying, oh yeah, I would have bought it there because the top right is where it ended up. That's easy enough, right? But it's kind of when you have to really make a decision without the advanced information behind you. From a chart standpoint, we're really just talking about chart and volume. That's all, you know, price and volume is all we're looking at. You know, so I think
there's an undertone here, Andrew. You know, you have to have a good story behind a stock and good numbers. But you also have to understand the technical side too. Now, it's probably 2/3 fundamental and 1/3 technical, the equation on buying a stock and how we do it and evaluate it. It's both. However, the technical is very important because in the stock market, everything is timing, like life.
Mm-hmm.
And if a stock is way up and you're entering at that point, your risk is significantly higher than if you're buying out of a consolidation area. That's why we use the chart. But you got to look at the fundamentals and have good numbers, and we have proprietary rankings and all. And so the game gives you that technical piece because so many people are deficient on the technical piece. And quite frankly, we would never dream of buying a stock without consulting a chart.
Right. I mean, that's just, of course, because you can have the best story, but it's really something else is going on behind the scenes. Whether it could be regulatory. You know, that maybe something's going to happen. It could be that you didn't realize that what you're looking at is one thing, but the advanced maybe guidance by the company is awful. You wouldn't see that. You wouldn't see that in the fundamentals.
Exactly.
You know, so you have to kind of, I think, put
that
together. Yep.
The chart never lies.
Never lies, I know. And the chart is always right, by the way, too.
And the chart's always right. Touche.
Do it.
That's right.
Okay, so let's get back to this idea of volume. So with all of the different types of trading that are there now, the mechanical, robotics, and all the different types of things that go on, is volume when it comes to the market? I'm not talking about a stock now. I'm talking about the market. Is the volume still really important to make sure that you have a market that is in a as you would call it, confirmed uptrend or a confirmed rally, whatever it was? Is that, do you think that's still something you have to stick by and really live and breathe by?
Yes, because volume, in essence, is telling you what the institutions are doing. You know, they're 80% of the market, roughly, and so it flows through into the indexes. When you see, like, these last 3 days that we've had some nice price action yesterday and the day before, guess what? The volume hasn't hit its 50-day average.
Been very weak, very, very weak.
So it's weak. Now you sit back and you say, okay, why? Well, they're not exactly plunging back in. So maybe a lot of institutions out there aren't buying on the dip because they're trying to lighten up on some positions because they're a little bit worried.
You know, what's interesting is that there was, in the beginning of the week, not only was there a uptick, which could have probably been, actually, I wrote about this Monday, and we put out a strategy that said, you know, that Monday into Tuesday, we're going to lighten up on this or do that. You know, we put out kind of like how we thought things would play out. Because you got end of quarter, end of month, you got the Greece thing, you got all this stuff going on. You know what was really phenomenal, though, was the light volume of the markets and the light volume in individual stock names, okay? But the price action of some of these stock names was off the charts.
That's right.
I mean, really ridiculously off the charts. We're talking about, you know, 6%, 7% here, 2% on a minimum over here. I mean, there was some real action there, but there was no volume. What does that say?
Well, that's my concern. I mean, you got so compressed over since May 2nd, coming down so fast, and I think it did catch a lot of people by surprise. And then when it tried to bounce those 4 different days and got reversed immediately, those are your big players trying to lighten up on stocks. So I think it's a reactionary bounce off the 200-day. I mean, we got down pretty far.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a predictor. I'm just interpreting. But let me give you a stat. Today, we formulated a list of what we would call the leading stocks from March of 2009 to present.
Right.
Okay? And of that list, it's around 70 or so. And you could debate 75 in around there. But it's around that universe. Half of them were up today, half were down. The ones that were up, 18% were up on an increase in volume. The rest of them were on mediocre volume today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last couple days, you have seen the same thing. They're up in big, like you said, big price action, but where's the volume? So this to me is very suspect.
You know, I was thinking about this. So we had some institutional selling a couple of weeks back, and then there was some, you know, a little bit of a rally for a day or so, and then a take back. What do you think about this? What do you think about the institutions? They're not stupid, and they know they want to unload for whatever reason, and they know they have a lot of shares. Yet there's not a lot of volume out there, and there's not a lot of takers. So what they could do is either slam the stock into smithereens, which they're not going to do because it's going to affect the rest of their portfolio.
Right.
What they'd rather do is sell some, kind of feel out the audience, see how much it's going to be able to be pushed before they really take it down. And then when they see that breaking point, when the bids are kind of drying up and there's, you know, it looks like this thing, just stop selling, wait a few days, let the, you know, the animal spirits kick up again, and then come right back in.
That's exactly what I think is happening.
Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, we didn't talk about that. That was that's interesting.
And let me give you an interesting point I'm looking at. If you get a chart and look at the indexes, I think we're going to run into a lot of overhead resistance. And right now we're just entering that zone, I'll call it, on the NASDAQ. Your listeners might want to jot down 2,700 to 2,800 on the NASDAQ, and the overhead resistance on the S&P, I'm putting it at 1,300 to 1,350.
That's a wide range.
A little bit of a wide, yeah. I'm giving it a little bit of room, but I think you're going to go right into that, and you're going to get stuck. Now, if we blast through that and then earnings cycle and whatever gets us going, then I become a bull again. But at this point, I'm negative and bearish because it's nothing's acting right. We're held hostage to the news.
Scott, have you ever remembered a time that the news moves the needle every single breath of it?
I know, and that's problematic. That's unnatural. You know, a lot of people think that because that's how it's been this decade, you know, plus a few years, that's normal. Well, it really isn't. To be so subject to the news of the day and to have so many problems around the world and domestically simultaneously, we're in a very unusual period. Quite frankly, I can't wait to, you know, have it leave.
Yeah.
And it may be another 18 months or so. I mean, who knows? But it's abnormal to have it like this.
Well, one of the reasons is that we have every single possible Fed minister, assistant, vice Fed somebody. They make the parade on a daily basis. That's for around the world. We got one guy that comes out and says, hey, you know what? I got to tell you something. Juncker comes out. Oh, terrible situation. Greece. Then 5 minutes later, Trichet comes out and contradicts it. You know, and then you got somebody else that comes out and says, oh, interest rates should be going up in the U.S. We see inflation. You know, 20 minutes later, oh, no inflation. Core is what we look. It's like, wait a minute, guys, get your stories together. I don't know what the purpose is of you constantly coming out on parade. But the bigger problem is you can have three different pieces of economic news during one day. The first one is bad. Markets take a hit. The second one is good. Markets go up. The third one is neutral. Whatever was last is what happens with the market.
Yeah, and so what I say to that, because I totally agree, is, you know, at a certain point, you get so twisted up mentally, you get lost, and you don't know what to do. Go back to your portfolio. What is your portfolio saying? What are the market averages saying? If your equity is getting chipped at, you know, death by a thousand cuts, day by day, when all of this noise is happening, you react to that. And don't sit there and try to make money based on the news, because in the end, you're going to end up a hamburger, in my opinion.
Yep,
You'll get chewed up. It doesn't work.
Right.
And they're all posturing out there anyway.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everyone's under pressure, so they're pointing fingers at the next guy. You know, it's not our fault, it's that guy, or it's the previous group of people. And all of it is posturing, and how do you know what's what? Well, you go back to the chart. The chart never lies.
I think, though, that there is some confusion at all levels. I mean, I would want to say that the institutions really have an inside of all this. But, I mean, you mentioned not only posturing, but there is it's almost like a collusion. What's going on, particularly in Europe? I mean, Trichet is talking about raising interest rates. I'm thinking, How in the world is there even a discussion of raising interest rates in Europe when there's this slowdown and a potential default of a few of the countries there? I mean, and we're all buying into this and going after the euro, which is a currency that is highly overvalued. It's like
we want
that to be the case because we know then that the dollar goes down and that's good for our stocks, good for the world. I want to talk about charts for a second. One of the things that I know that you do is you look at a different time frames to get a sense of what's happening on a longer term. For example, you know, weekly is very important to look at the big picture or bigger picture, and it smooths out some of the moves. It kind of compresses it differently. You look at a 10-week and a 40-week average, right?
I look at the 50-day and 200-day. That's
right.
Same thing.
And then the second thing, though, that's very important, and I want to make sure everybody listens to this. This is extremely important. I want you to explain this, that there is a difference, a very important difference on the daily chart and the weekly chart. On a daily, and we do this also, on a daily chart, you look at the daily numbers in normal fashion. On a weekly chart, use a log scale because it properly sets up in a much better way, particularly when you're using moving averages, so that you can see the actual movement so that a 10 to a 20 dollar move, $10 share to $20 a share, is the same move as a $20 share to a $40 share.
Yeah.
Explain that a little.
Well, that's an important little detail. You're very astute. And we've been doing charts for 50 years, and so we take these little details extremely seriously. And scaling, for instance, the chart has to truly represent exactly what you're looking at, exactly what's happening to that stock. I would recommend that your listeners train their eye on a weekly chart first, for the reasons you mentioned, and also it evens as you mentioned, it evens out the moves a little bit, and it's easier to interpret. And also, if you focus too short-term, daily, and you know, I have friends that, a few friends that will focus on inner days and all, that is so fast and ridiculous, you're not capturing a move to its fullest, which is really your goal. You want to buy right, hold the stock, and sell it when it's done at the top. Sell it right. So that whole process starts training your eye on a weekly, and then you go over to a daily to go a little deeper. And if I'm really interested in the stock, I'll glance at a monthly just to see the longer term. But a weekly is the most important to us.
Well, a stock that we like, and I thought it was really – we don't go to the monthlies very often, but I thought it was really important to do so because I remember something from the past, is a stock of a company called Crocs. Let me just say right now, it is still – mind-boggling how well these shoe companies do. I just want to state that point.
What a turnaround on that puppy!
Yeah. And we were I don't know. We didn't know each other back then, but I was screaming off the rafters to get the hell out of the stock in the '60s, way back when. And I thought you thought I would actually murder somebody's family the way I got these emails. Okay, but Crocs. What's really interesting, by the way, just to speak about Crocs, you should go to their website and see some of the stuff they have now. It's not just those ugly looking pink things.
Yeah, the lights and yeah.
Oh yeah, the new chameleon.
By the way, there's a few of us in our shop that got caught in Crocs at the top, and we're screaming at our traders too.
Oh yeah. That was ugly. We were like, get out of this thing. But here's the thing.
Which is a great reason when you see this breaking down on the chart, you don't sit there and ask questions and say, but their shoes are cool and they're comfortable.
Right.
You get out of there.
Right. You can always get back in. That's I think something that people don't always think about, you know, because they think get out of a stock. Oh my God, I can't get back in. So the discussion with Scott O'Neill, I think, really holds some good weight when we think about what is happening, because the trend these days has been, in the last year or so, has been so sporadic, so just news-driven. And when you look at things, the fundamentals are important, but also the technicals. And that's really, I think, what Scott brought to the table in that discussion back in July. You know, then in August, we had a couple of really good people on. We had, Kevin Hoffman came back in around that time, Larry Williams, Amy Smith, Vitaly Katanelson, and Michael Rosenberg. We also had on a show, we brought on John Markman. Now, John is just a wonderful writer, a great reader of markets. He also has new futures-driven strategy. And in that discussion, we had kind of the markets and what the future would hold and some kind of insight from John on what was going on. And to say that stocks are cheap right now is constantly trying to find reason to just buy, because I don't think I've seen, in besides maybe a handful of people that have said that, you know, stocks are going to go much lower. I mean, on TV and in the media, it's all about stocks going higher and what to buy. Don't you think?
Well, to me, Andrew, it all pivots around one central question. If you can answer this question in your own mind, you know, you'll have the key to Rebecca. The big question is, will there be a U.S. recession, and or will there be a global synchronized recession? If you think that there will not be a recession, then stocks are too cheap and they should go higher. They should go at least to 1250 and possibly back to their highs. If you think that there will be a recession and stocks are too high and probably have to go to at least 850, which is about 250 points lower than where we are now, 300 points lower than we are now, and in a really bad recession in which, you know, Europe falls apart, unravels basically, and Asia follows, then there's no question that the S&P will go back to its 2009 low.
Charles Nenner
was on. You need to answer that question in your own mind.
Right.
Because, you know, the people who say that prices are too low are not looking, they always preface their statements by saying something like, there will be no double-dip recession.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they always start with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on to the others, which are true. Short-term interest rates are anchored at zero. That's mm-hmm. true. Inflation and inflationary expectations are contained. That's true, and that's very important for a bull market. Corporate balance sheets are strong, and earnings growth has been strong as well. And that's important, and that's both true. Valuations based on past results are low, and that is true. They are low.
Mm-hmm.
The yield on S&P 500 stocks is lower than the 10-year note. That's true. Investors' expectations are limited. That's also true. Hedge funds have de-risked. That's true. Okay. And retail investors have basically abandoned the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not completely true, but it's true enough for what we're talking about. So all those things are accurate. Now, and are facts. The only thing that's not a fact and that's an opinion is whether there's going to be a recession or not. And that's why you really have to determine in your own mind. Now, for my own self, I like to lean on the opinion of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, led by Lakshman Akhman.
Now that's impressive that you can say his name. That's good.
I've been talking to Lakshman for about almost two decades now, and his cycle work is fantastic
yep.
at being able to call a recession when it's 3 to 6 months away. His weekly leading indicator is declining in a pervasive,
mm-hmm.
profound way. And my expectation is that it's not too far away from him using that to declare that a recession is on the way. If and when that he does that, that will still not be a mainstream point of view because
mm-hmm.
his cycle work is still considered to be outside the mainstream. However, it was a fascinating interview last night on Bloomberg out of Wyoming with Martin Feldstein, who was a Harvard economist
mm-hmm.
and was actually head of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the organization that actually dates recessions.
Wasn't he also in the movie Young Frankenstein?
he looks a little like Igor, yes.
Oh, that was Marty Feldman, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that's a different one. So, Feldstein's considered a very, very good mainstream economist.
Uh-huh.
He said something that actually kind of shocked me last night. He said that he sees a better than 50% chance of recession. He says that if there is a recession, he thinks it will probably be dated back, the start of it will have been dated back in December 2010.
Wow.
And he said it's also possible that when they go back and sift through the data, they may decide that the recession of 2008 never ended.
Hmm.
So there's actually three scenarios he mentioned. One is that the recession never ended. The second is that that we are currently in what they call a double dip, which is you have a recession and then you have two quarters of growth and then a new recession, and that's a possibility. And the third possibility is that you had a recession, you had four quarters of growth, and now we're having a new recession.
Right, right, right.
So at any rate, you know, there's a better. He thinks that there's a better than 50% chance that there will be determine a recession, because growth is clearly slowing down to the zero bound. Okay. Now, you could also say, well, if there's a 50% chance there will be, there's a 50% chance there won't be.
Right, yeah.
And that's true, too. And that's why this is really a pivotal moment. Investors really have to decide for themselves, you know, in using the data and also using your intuition, which is helpful. You know, are we entering a recession? When I come in contact with people who have contact with the public or in business, I always ask them, you know, how's business? You know, how are your customers? How do you think people, in your view, from the ground, how do you see business today? And I would say that most of the people that I talk to, at least in the Seattle area, and where I've traveled in Colorado and Florida recently, most people don't think that what they are seeing constitutes a extreme slowdown.
Hmm.
I just had a discussion with my tennis partner last night, who is a loan officer, and he's very much has an opportunity to see all sections of the economy here in the Seattle area. And he says most of his customers are still taking loans and they're growing. So I thought that was very optimistic.
Well, we're not going to talk right now about the fact that you're in Florida and I didn't hear from you when you were down here, but that will do another time. What I think is interesting and fascinating is that probably some of Feldstein's work was based on, or his new opinion is based on, the fact that we had this recent revision going back, I guess, a year and a half, that chopped off about $400 billion. I mean, we're not talking about a rounding error at this point. $400 billion worth of our GDP over the last few years, which is pretty, I think that pretty much shocked people, because I do believe there's a section of people who believe that the government has been very optimistic somehow in a lot of their data. And you don't want to think that. You want to hope that the data is clean.
You want to hope that the data is clean, but you got to remember, a lot of it is not really data per se, it's models.
Yeah.
Or sort of synthetic views of what the data is showing. So you kind of have to take some of these revisions with a grain of salt. Also, just to throw out a little bone for the conspiracy theorists out there, you know, there are a lot of people who think that the government manipulates the GDP data for its own benefit. And, you know, you would say, like, why would it benefit anybody for the economy to be seen weaker than it is today? Well, if you're the administration and you're not running for office today, you're running for office in 9 months to a year or a year and a half, it benefits you to have the data, the economy seem poor now, but improve later after you've had a chance to work your well-publicized miracles.
Hmm.
So, you know, if the economy is weak now, let's say, unemployment at 9%, GDP at, you know, let's say 1% to be generous. But the headlines in a year from now, when people are starting to focus on the conventions, say that the unemployment is at, let's say, 8% or 7%, and GDP growth is trucking along at more like 3%, then the administration can say that they've improved things and they're on the right track.
Right.
So can they do that? They absolutely can. Will they do that? Do they do that? I think that most administrations will admit that they do something like that, you know, by putting pressure on various, you know, data releasing organizations, you know, within your organization, whether it's Commerce or BLS. Do I have any evidence of it? I don't.
Right.
I don't have any evidence, but I do suspect that it happened.
Let me get back to the ECR for ECR.
By the way, when you read the memoirs of former members of government, they certainly hint to it.
Yeah, no kidding. It's only after the fact. It's almost like the fascinating and quite amazing metamorphosis of Greenspan, who was just totally, you know, it spoke in a language that nobody understood at all in any of his tenure as Fed chief. But as soon as he seemed like put a book out, you understood everything he said when he goes on talk shows. It's like, who's this guy? You know?
Yep.
So, but going back to Lashman and the ECRI, I track that. I think I've sent you some of my charts of that on a weekly basis.
Yeah, you do amazing data work.
Yeah, colors are good, right? We like the colors. Kind of tells the story three-dimensionally a bit. But he also puts out the growth rate. And his growth rate numbers, there's a bunch of different things he puts out. But he puts out a weekly index, the leading index, which obviously is more current than the monthly that's put out by the conference board. Conference board. And then there's also he also puts out that. And he puts out the growth rate, the leading growth rate. And that's interesting because that, I think, for the first time in a very long time, actually, has dipped under zero.
Yeah, you got to be a little careful with that because it's not the growth rate of the economy; it's the growth rate of the index.
Right. No, I understand.
So he's measuring the acceleration and deceleration of his index. So it does, all by itself, it doesn't provide any information. What's really important is which way is the index headed, and is it moving in a profound and pervasive way?
Yeah, I think it dropped another 1.5 points or something like that. 2.5%. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, but, you know, if things start to stabilize, you know, there's a lot of interesting factors in that model. You know, some of it's the stock market. Some of it is, you know, housing starts. Some of it is the, I kid you not, the price of tallow and cardboard.
No, that's basically important. Shipping.
He likes to look at commodities that aren't priced by the market. In other words, that are priced internally by companies. Rather, there's no futures contracts because he thinks that those are more real.
Right.
So the index has a way of looking around the corners. So even though we're kind of hoping that it's not hoping, expecting that it's directional, I've seen very many times in the past where it kind of turns the corner when nobody's looking.
Yeah.
When anyone's expecting it. So I would wait. I would wait for him to give the call.
Yeah.
He's
so,
the expert.
So here's the question I have, though. This is something I think has to be explored because, even though I hate saying this time is different, I'm not talking about a this time is different thing. I'm talking about how some of the nature of what goes into a company's profits are different now than, let's say, they were 2 decades ago. So, for example, I'm not sure what the difference is between a 0.1 growth rate on GDP and a negative 0.1, if you understand what I'm saying, that fine line that would say, oh, you're in a recession. I mean, does everybody just start freaking out in the streets when they call a recession? Or is it just, you know, hey, we're in a very slow growth rate? But here's the thing. I do agree that there are two components here. There's a global issue and there's a U.S. issue. I'm not so sold on the fact that if the U.S. goes into a recession or at least we continue on the slow path, that necessarily is a terrible thing for, let's say, a certain grouping of stocks. The stock market may, I hate to use this also, decouple a little bit, certain stocks, because they're much more global dependent these days when you see that they are having a lot of their income from other areas.
Well, there's no doubt that certain elite group of large cap internationals are doing quite well even right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the stocks of McDonald's, Kimberly-Clark, Coca-Cola, a few others, you would say, you know, what the market's like, you know, what recession, everything looks hunky-dory.
Yep.
And these companies, you know, are sell to, you know, emerging markets and have to have most of their earnings overseas today. But I would caution you, if there is a recession, a real recession, that gathers strength and has a negative feedback loop, that's really important. Once a recession starts, it has a reinforcing negative effect. It's almost certain to drag down the rest of the world. It's almost unavoidable. And not only that, but, you know, in our discussion, we've only been talking about the United States. But and the reason that people like my loan officer friend and that people who are pretty optimistic about the U.S. market may be missing the boat is that they're really underestimating the effect that a banking crisis in Europe can have on the United States.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And there is a banking crisis. As a matter of fact, the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde.
Yeah.
We need to Smiths and Jones again to make it easier. But this weekend said that there is an urgent necessity to have the European banks raise their capital requirements and shore up their balance sheets to avoid a catastrophe. And, you know, it seems like one day we're fine, one day we're not. Greek yields on their bonds went up to about 42.5% last week, a record
high.
When
you say the yields on their bonds, what that doesn't say is that that's the amount that Greek people need to pay to roll over the country's debt. So whereas we pay, you know, less than 1% for short-term money in the United States, and, you know, 3.5% or whatever for 10-year money. So the Greeks are paying literally 40% per annum to roll over their debts. Well, that's pawnbroker money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not sustainable.
Right.
So, you know, if that continues, and there really doesn't seem to be much will to prevent that from happening, you know, Greece is going to default, you know, and it's a horrible thing to say. But it's not benign, because if Greece defaults, there's a whole line, there's a long line of effects that can tumble from that, which are not pretty. And, you know, people make fun of Greece by saying it's, you know, has an economy less than the size of Maryland. Well, that's not the point. The point is that if European banks have to take a haircut what they're owed by the Greek government. They need to either be made whole, or they need to raise their capital requirements. They need to raise their reserves, and they don't have the money for that.
Right, and who wants to give it to them? Because then,
who's going to give it to them?
Right, if you give it to them, you're essentially saying, "Okay, here's money because we know you're going to get a haircut. Why would you do such a thing?"
Exactly, and not only that, but you know, those the Europeans depend on this crazy system called the Eurozone.
Oh, what a mess!
Which is kind of a mess. They have the same currency, but they don't have a treasury. They don't have a taxation force. They don't even have an agreement on what to do if one of the members gets in trouble. They have an emergency agreement right now called EFSF, which sort of papered over the problems back in the spring. But there's really no agreement among the Europeans, particularly the Germans, who are the richest country in Europe, as to whether that that emergency fund is even valid, much less whether they will pay out for it.
And a couple things, John. Number one, regarding that, they ponied up $1 trillion, you know, or so in that, and kind of pulled some money to protect what they thought would be, you know, kind of a shock and awe campaign, and that helped for a little while. The second thing was that the ECB. It's interesting. The ECB has literally put up money with no different than what we did here in the Fed, where they printed money to buy the bonds and to do what they did. They don't want to buy the bonds of Greece and of Italy and all that. And they don't have enough money, actually, to cover anything more than a breakdown, really, in Greece. That's it. There's no other money. And then you got to say, where's the money going to come from? Well, Germany is just pissed off as can be. You know, they're the one economy that was the center holding point, the keel of the whole entire area. And they're just getting slammed. I think the citizens there are pissed off. They're putting Mercedes on fire all over the place. You have France, by the way, which I think is the biggest problem here. Because France owns the largest amount, and the banks in France, Société Générale and all these, they own the largest amount of the worst debt that's out there. Five of their banks did not pass the stress test, which was, you know, questionable to begin with, out of the 10 or so that entirely didn't pass in the region. Five or so of the French banks didn't pass. So, you know, you're looking at a situation there that is almost like a gigantic snowball that just will not stop, because while Trichet is all for bailouts, because, of course, he's from France and he wants that to happen, Merkel's like, what are you talking about? Are you out of your minds?
And you're talking about Angela Merkel, who's the Chancellor of Germany, and
right.
Trichet, who's the head of the European Central Bank.
Right.
And you're right. These are real issues. And over here in the United States, you know, my loan officer friend who thinks that business is fine, you know, he's not looking at that. If you're just a technician looking at the stock market in the United States, you're not looking at that. And I do think that we're vulnerable to being blindsided by those issues.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that how closely connected their U.S. banks are with the European debt. I read a really interesting stat over the weekend. In normal times, up to 40% of U.S. money market money is invested in short-term in commercial paper of European banks. And that money is on the U.S. government has quietly told U.S. banks to stop that practice and basically bring back their money. Okay?
Yep.
And that is contributing
right
to the funding crisis in Europe. It is helping shore up the U.S. relationship shore up the potential for problems with U.S. banks, but it also exacerbates the problems with the European banks.
Right. And then, you know, people, I think, are that's why this whole discussion from the Fed, I think it was 2 weeks ago, quietly on the weekend, Bernanke said, you know what, we want an accounting of what the risk is here, because we're also seeing that the interbank lending rates are quietly creeping higher. You know, in the height of the meltdown of Lehman, there was this LIBOR spread that we talk about that was kind of moving, and it got, you know, like 3% at that point. It was the interbank lending, basically, and the spread between the U.S. and the European. And the problem was that the overnight lending got ridiculous. I mean, it was nobody would lend to each other. The banks, you know, which are very apt to, like you said, lend back and forth and create liquidity, weren't doing it. And we have a liquidity problem that's building up pretty fast here.
And one of the things that's kind of curious right now is that LIBOR is not moving up as quickly
or
as strongly. as it did during the last crisis. So you can take that two ways. You know, either that's a good thing. It is moving up, by the way, but not at the accelerated rate that we saw during the 2008 crisis. It is. You can say that it's a good thing, and maybe concerns are overblown, or you can say it's coming.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about Japan? I mean, Japan is quietly also, a lot of quiet things going on. I have a really interesting question for you after this, too, about Japan. But Japan is now in a recession, right? They have three quarters of negative GDP.
Right.
And what I find fascinating about that is that there's a lot of talk, well, look what happened because of the earthquake. And the GDP negative print, the first one was before the earthquake.
Yeah, well, you know, poor Japan.
Poor Japan.
A country that I love and I've studied for many years. You know, they were the second largest economy in the world after the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been passed by China and by Europe. But you know, you can't just sort of wave your hand and say, "Oh, Japan, it doesn't matter. They've been out of it for a long time." Still the second, or you know, the third or fourth largest economy in the world. And when they're not buying stuff, when they're not buying metal, when they're not buying tissue paper, when they're not buying Coca-Cola, because the economy is shrinking and their prospects are thinning, it's a big problem for the rest of the world. You know, it's really a drag.
I mean, John really had a good point there when he talked about the whole global economy being interlinked in general, and China, and how it's going to be a drag if the people aren't stocking up as they were in terms of the countries and buying whatever they can to create the ongoing demand for goods and commodities, et cetera. And again, that was back in, if you think about it, back in August. Now, 1 month later, or a few weeks later, we had Frank Curzio, a good stock picker, great stock picker, great writer, and one of the favorites of the listeners here, of all of us. And we talked there about, in that time, the issue of transparency and what was happening with regard to the ability for us to understand what was happening and the information flow that we were using to make decisions. Frank is passionate. So you got two crazy New Yorkers on the line here talking about a passionate area of theirs. But, you know, one of the things that really is very, I think that is very concerning and disturbing is the lack of transparency through Europe, number one. And the second thing is that it almost appears that investors are being led into an experiment and, you know, kind of with a hook in the mouth, and the government doesn't really have any practical experience with what they've done, and the amount of money they've thrown away is extraordinary. And, you know, I think that once the average Joe gets aware of the, wow, what, that didn't really work so well, like QE2, QE3 is not going to have the same effect, and the government carrot is not going to have the same effect.
Well, I could tell you this. You use the word experiment, and they have tried this before. And I'm just saying out that whether you're bull or bear, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. This is just, you know, I'm going to throw out some facts for you here. We've only seen interest rates this low relatively two times in our history. We've seen it right after, you know, post-war, 1945, 46, 47. We had a terrible period in the markets, and then we pushed rates exceptionally low. And then we had mortgage rates, I think, at 4.5%, and it resulted in one of the biggest housing booms in history in the 1950s. Again, we went through a period that was absolutely terrible. We look at 2001, when we came off the internet boom, and you know, stocks crashed. Everybody knows the story. Then we had September 11th. We began lowering interest rates in 2001, and it took till 2005 before that actually impacted the market, and we all know what happened. We had one of the biggest booms in market history, and you know, everything hit all-time highs. Of course, you know, you could see what happened with the consequences of that, where we had little regulation, and everybody knows that story as well. But what the Fed's trying to do with QE3 is basically buy time, because usually, you know, people are going to say, well, it doesn't work. Well, you don't want the market crashing in the middle of when you have the lowest interest rates in history, where in history it's proven that low interest rates creates booming economies for the U.S. I mean, we won't go to Japan. Japan is a totally different animal. I mean, they have, you know, in 2002, they had a population of 127 million people. Today, they have a population of 126 million people. I mean, it's a totally different animal, and people are going to cite, you know, Japan to the U.S. But usually when we have periods of low interest rate, it results in an enormous economic boom, and that's what the government is hoping for. Whether it's going to happen or not, who knows? But the alternative is, if you sit there and do nothing, you could see, you know, we have to pay interest on these debt payments. And if interest rates go higher, we're in a lot of trouble. I mean, those debt payments become huge. So I could see where the government's coming from with QE3. Will it work? I don't know. But I understand, you have to understand that when we have periods of low interest rates, it usually results in a huge economic boom. It hasn't happened yet. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen in the future, but something to look forward to. I think that's where the Fed's head's at.
But the problem you have here, Frank, is something that I think everybody is starting to wonder about. If you have already put the pedal to the metal with regard to your interest rate policy being zero, you can't go negative. Let's just talk about that and say that. And if there are no other policies available, take, for example, what Brazil did last week. Brazil has been raising interest rates for the last several, many, many months to try to tame their inflation, which has been a direct hit from our situation over here. And, you know, the bottom line is that they had the ability to actually bring down their rates as the economy was slowing. We don't have that ability right now. So the of course that the Fed says, I mean, can you imagine if the Fed said we have no more tools left? That's not going to work. So the Fed says we have plenty of tools left just to either bamboozle us, to lead us on, or maybe it's true. But what are the tools? They have QE. They have the ability to move out on the on the yield curve to buy that. They also have the ability to print more money and to value our money. They also have the ability to adjust some of the banking deposit issues. What else do they have? It's a monetary policy. That's it.
They're telling them, selling short-term bonds, buying long-term bonds, help interest low. But realize one of the things that you said, which is really crazy. Again, I'm not agreeing with anything that they're doing here, but the power to print money is enormous. I mean, they obviously know they could print money forever and just spark programs, put it towards infrastructure, which has never worked based on every study I've ever read. I've done a lot of homework on this, that, you know, trying to provide money for infrastructure, it just doesn't create jobs. I don't know why they continue to push us down the road, and maybe that will have to – might be factored into QE3 down the road. But the fact that they just continue to print money is really a crazy thought. But that's I mean, for people to say, well, the Fed's out of bullets or you know, they're not out of bullets. They could print money for every, you know, they could print money forever. So there's other things they could do. I don't want to see them do it. However, they're probably going to go with QE3 based on the latest round of economic data, which shows that, you know, we're not really growing. And keep in mind, the only, and I mean the only solution to our problems right now is either default or we have massive economic growth. I mean, that's it. I mean, I don't know if default would be a solution, but those are the only two outcomes right now. So, you know, they're going to put the, you know, pedal to the metal and keep printing money and try to inflate this economy and try to build this economy so we can work off our debts. That's their goal. I don't know if it's going to work, though, like I said.
Well, Frank, just to give you an update, obviously we are having some big decisions to be made very shortly and some, I would say fighting and deliberation about whether it's going to work or not, because obviously there's been the continuation of a need for the government to stimulate here, and at the same time there's been a backlash about the debt that's grown, right? So where it goes from here is anyone's guess. But it's definitely starting to look like there's going to be the continuation of the various credit agencies putting the kibosh on anything we do that is above and beyond the cost of the debt that we have currently outstanding, and the constant talk of QE3 or some other kind of stimulus from the Fed continues. And obviously, I think we'll end this with a great commentary from Das. He was with us in the latter part of the year, in November, talking about the whole European crisis, what's happening there, and a bit of a reality check in terms of what to expect from Europe. You know, I don't think that there was an understanding, you know, how much there really is this this knock-on effect when you have a sovereign nation who basically can just issue bonds and keep on keeping on. And then the problem with Europeans seem to be that they don't want to really give up their own independence. And then on top of that, you have a government that I don't even know what's going on in Greece, because what they did last week with the new election of another prime minister falls through. I mean, I don't understand why they're not getting this, except for the fact that they know no matter what happens, they're getting their $100 billion.
Look, I think fundamentally the Greek politics, the issues around Silvio Berlusconi, and people forget there's political problems aplenty elsewhere. I'll give you two examples which nobody talks about. One is in Spain. They have an election coming up which is between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Mm. And there's a wonderful cartoon in Spain where somebody watches the debate between these two people, and the guy says, I wonder who will be running Spain after the election. And his wife says, it doesn't matter among those two. It's going to be Angela Merkel.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, so there's all this elections going on, but crucially in Netherlands and Germany, in Netherlands, the coalition, believe it or not, the government relies on the opposition to vote with them to pass European bailout legislation. And the opposition have said they're sick of it because nothing is going to solve this problem, and why should they put their political capital into this equation? And in Germany, there's this wonderful guy called Franz Schäffler, who's a member of the FDP, which is in coalition with Angela Merkel's CDU. And he is a fairly astute, he's not an important politician, but what he's actually done is he's used the FDP constitution very carefully. What he's done is he's got this referendum where the FDP are going to vote because their individual members have the right to determine party policy. And they're going to vote about whether they want to support the bailout packages. And he's got enough votes. Between now and December, he'll have enough votes to basically withdraw the FDP potentially from this coalition, which will almost certainly create a huge problem for Angela Merkel and may ultimately bring down a government. So the politics is an entire mess, but the reality is you could change the leaders, you could change the government, but it's like changing effectively the captain of the Titanic after he's rammed the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problems that they're all going to confront is exactly the same. And the Europeans have wasted 2 years prevaricating, pretending that the problem doesn't exist, and then coming up with these astonishingly half-baked solutions. I mean, the crucial thing that people did not focus on the 27th of October announcement of, you know, yet another grand comprehensive plan which was going to fix everything, was the whole crucial thing was no European country, especially Germany and France, were going to put one more euro into saving these countries. And the whole thing was, it was like almost like a surreal fantasy. We're not going to put any more money in. You know, everything will be fine. And, you know, this magic thing called the bailout fund, the European Financial Stability Facility, will somehow come up with all this money with sort of a little bit of, you know, we'll put a bit of Chinese money and a bit of Indian money in, and we'll stir it around and we'll borrow it from the IMF. And somehow, miraculously, it'll work. Now, I mean, these guys, and I just don't get why markets believe these guys actually have a solution, simply because they haven't got a solution. I mean, you and I both know the answer. The answer is people have made bad loans. They're going to have to write it off. There's going to be a massive wealth loss, and it's going to take us a decade, maybe more, to work our way through that.
Wait. Just this week, I think it was Stark said it's only going to take 1 to 2 years, and the market had, in the U.S., had a miraculous 1.5% turnaround. And I said, let me get this straight. Stark said that it's going to take 1 to 2 years. That's what was blamed on this big market run-up earlier in the week. And, you know, wouldn't it be, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't it be nice if somebody could give me a little bit of backup data on this besides just coming out of his ass?
There's no way it's going to take 1 to 2 years.
But how does he say this and people believe it without any kind of data, without, this could have been a discussion at a lunchtime speech that there's nothing backing it up, there's no projections, and everybody just takes this crap as face value. And I blame the press for this, by the way.
I think there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, and you can blame two groups of people. One is, it's very clear to me that the politicians and the policymakers, because they've run out of options, really, they have no more options. They're not trying to do a confidence game. And as I said, the one thing about the recent plan was they got the con part right. It was the rest of the word confidence that was missing.
Right.
And the next thing is the press. And essentially, I find the reporting these days of financial matters to be fairly variable. There are good writers, but on the whole, the level of qualification of these people, I don't know what they are, but they don't really actually get whatever it is that they need to get. But most importantly, they're unquestioning. They report this stuff, which is really Stark's opinion, and effectively as kind of a fact, Europe will recover in 1 to 2 years. And I'm sitting there going, no. And by the way, that contrasts hugely with Angela Merkel, who about the same time came back from the G20 grumbling that nobody was going to give Europe any money, and also grumbling that that the whole problem would go on for a very long time, and C, the fact that Europe probably should never have led Greece into the euro. I mean, it was quite surreal to think that all of these problems can be solved in 1 to 2 years.
Well, then you have also that right after the Stark announcement, I think a day later, the IMF came out and said that there's a significant risk to the, but then again, this whole thing goes back and forth. On one day, there's a lot of risk, markets sell off. The other day, somebody says, hey, things are much better, and the markets move up. It's a very, very stressful situation for investors. My listeners are, getting like to a point that they're wondering, what really is going on around here? Because, you're right. The reporting is pretty awful. There is no questioning. I constantly am writing writers and saying, why don't you stop with this anonymous crap and this unnamed source? I think it's a terrible, terrible practice. And all they're doing really is using you to test out ideas on the market.
Exactly.
So that's a problem. And then finally, I think the biggest issue is that when we look at all of this and try to put our heads around all this, you have to believe somebody. So do we believe, or you could be that curmudgeonly guy and say, I don't believe anybody. But then where does that get you? You have to believe something. So do we believe Bernanke and all that? I don't know. Do we believe? Listen.
Well, actually, I got accused the other day of being a destructionist.
Oh.
And I said, I'm not familiar. Is that a religion or is it a political party? And he said, no, you just want the world to be destroyed. I said, frankly, if I wanted the world to be destroyed, I'd just basically sit here and do nothing, say nothing, because it's doing a pretty good job on its own.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm saying these things is I'm trying to get people to actually think about some of these things. I'm not saying I have any answers, because there are probably very limited options, and some may work, some may not work. But people have to think about it. But, you have to go back. In my view, you have to go back, and particularly in periods of stress, simplify it down. The first thing is, if you actually look at Europe, just let's look at the hard numbers. Even with the plan, Greece's debt to GDP is going to be 120% in 2021.
That was their goal.
And I'm saying, sorry, this is going to save them, is it?
Right,
this is going to save them.
Right.
And then you listen to the lies, like, oh, we've cut 50%. And you say, yeah, but you've cut 50% of the $200 billion, which is owed to banks. By the way, of that $200 billion, 85 is owed to Greek banks and Greek pension funds. So let's reduce that down to 115 to external lenders. We're cutting 57.5 billion euros, which by any stretch of the imagination is a sizable sum of money, but it's 15% of the total debt burden.
And by the way, how that didn't trigger CDS,
I have no idea. Manipulated.
Right.
But it's even funnier, Andrew, because the reason we only cut the 50% off the 60% of the 200 million was the European Central Bank, which owns about 80 billion of Greek bonds. If there'd been a 50% write-off, they've got 5 billion in capital. They'd be bankrupt.
Mm.
So that's why it was done. So people have to look through to the facts and see what those facts mean. Like the 106 billion that the banks have to raise in capital. I mean, it's just ludicrous. Number one, that's only covering Greece. What about Ireland? What about Portugal? What about Spain and Italy, which is obviously now hugely problematic? And also, what about the second-order effects? If all these countries have problems, what's growth going to look like? What are the second-order effects on the normal cyclical bad debts of the banks? And then you have the person doing this forecast is the European Banking Authority, the EBA, which, by the way, was the same people who said in July this year that the entire European banking system needed 2.5 billion euros in capital. And Dexia, which is now bankrupt pretty much, was actually in the top 10 of best capitalized banks in Europe.
Yeah, we put that out there. That was an unbelievable. They had the cleanest balance. They had the best capital, tier one capital ratios, and they were highly recommended. And that was only a few months ago, and really quite astonishing. What was being hidden by Dexia that they couldn't find, or what they're not seeing. But then again, it's again the same thing. It's a combination, I think. You said, well, what, if I don't say anything and, am I a destructionist if I talk about this stuff? I think the truth is that this whole confidence game is what is the glue that holds together economies. I really do.
Oh, I agree with you. And one of the things that I'm now starting to think is what the end game is, not only in an economic sense or a financial sense, but a social and political sense. And I think if you actually look at this, and you look at what happened in the 1920s, is there was a complete breakdown in trust. And, our societies are basically held together with a glue. And that confidence you're talking about is part of a fabric of trust, that we believe the data, we believe people are telling the truth, and we believe they have the best interests of everybody at heart. And I can point to sort of four or five things now where there's a complete breakdown in trust. One, I mean, the answer to everything is out of print money. I mean, money has to have some value, particularly paper money. People have to believe in it. Now, if everybody's just going to turn the printing presses on and just keep printing money, it's not going to fix the problem, we know that. But it's going to undermine the value of money. And you can see this. And you can see this in the gold price going up. And putting money into gold, while I can understand why people do it, isn't terribly productive. You know, other than a few gold miners around the world who dig the stuff out of the ground.
Yeah, you know what? And I think what you're describing is a cruise with unlimited alcohol and just you going to the bar constantly and then realizing at the end that somebody's got to pay for this.
Absolutely. And then you undermine government bonds. I mean, if you want to really undermine the financial system, once you actually lose the concept of one truly safe, secure asset, I mean, everything else becomes impossible.
Right.
I mean, that's what they're doing. Then, of course, you look at the institutions. I mean, in the United States, you have at this moment this huge trend away from major banks to credit unions and so forth, which is started by the woman over the Bank of America debit card fees. But that shows just the complete lack of belief in these institutions. I mean, you know, the banks in the United States used to be Jimmy Stewart,
yep.
And It's a Wonderful Life.
Yep.
At the moment, I tell you what, it would be Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Hanging.
Yeah, no, so there is no, every once in a while we'll invest a little bit in the banks. I mean, short term. When I say short term, I mean short term. You know, like very couple of days kind of thing. But generally speaking, they scare the bejesus out of me. And the truth of the matter is that I don't understand, back to Europe, for example, how that's, you know, all being played out. Asia's a little bit tougher to figure out because their data is a little bit more, I guess. Yeah. And around the world, otherwise, it's kind of like questionable. And, you know, I don't never recommend and haven't in years getting anything near a bank or Latin America bank, because, you know, once you have a situation where you take bold action to devalue, it becomes easier in the future.
Absolutely. And I think this is a breakdown of trust. And you look at, and what we've been talking about is a breakdown in fundamental things like, A, the systems we have, the policy options we have clearly been shown to be inadequate. And also the institutions, the politicians, we were talking about just the faith in these people. And they're turning out to be, A, I mean, people can make mistakes. I can understand people in very difficult circumstances making mistakes. None of us are perfect. None of us know everything. But the point is, they're now blatantly not telling anybody the truth. They're pretending there are no problems when there are problems. And also, what is really, to my mind, the most egregious part of it, is they have to be honest with their populations, with their voters, and say, look, it's going to be difficult. I mean, I was on a program very recently about Greece, and there were a lot of Greeks on this program, Greek Australians and also Greeks in Greece. And the fundamental thing that they were saying is, look, we're willing to take pain. We're willing to do what's necessary. They're a proud people with a tremendously long history. But, you know, what we see is people just essentially, the politicians and the bankers, looting us and expecting us to suffer 50, 60% losses of income in perpetuity. And we're not going to take it.
Yeah.
No, and it's going to be like that famous line from, I think it's the Peter Finch movie, Network. You know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I talked about that last week on a podcast, and somebody, I said that was from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and they yelled at me that I got the wrong movie. I'm like, I did? That's funny that you mentioned that. Listen, let's kind of get on to a couple of different things. Number one, I think that there is a fine line between, you know, hell and damnation and going down the tubes and everything suffers, which is kind of like the good day or bad day. It's a very manic market in the U.S. and around the world. You know, you go to sleep and then you know, with one set of information points, right? And you wake up truly a few hours later, like, what happened? What changed? Where did everything go? And I think that there is something to be said, though, about there is the potential for good companies to still do well. That doesn't mean the stock is necessarily going to do well, but the companies may do well. You know, there's still mouths to feed. There's places to go. There's clothes to buy. There's houses to build. There is a situation where, you know, the economies still move on around the world. And even with, you know, a lot of the slowdown, there's still a lot of need. But that problem is that at the end of the day, and I wrote an article about this week, is, you know, if I hear one more person talk about the market is cheap due to P.E. ratio, I'm going to kill them. Because using P.E. ratio is the stupidest formula to measure what the market's value is in terms of cheapness or expensive, because what you're looking at is one number over history. And the problem is that P.E. ratio is not a simple, when you talk about it that way, you can't talk about it simply by, okay, price, earnings, that's it. No, you need to take out sentiment. You need to look at future projection and growth. You need to look at interest rates and all that. Now, when you do that and you want to talk about it in a formula and say, well, P.E.s are cheap because whatever, fine. But if just to say P.E.s are cheap, this is what I'm telling everybody. When you hear that the next time in media, you hear that on or read that anywhere, everything that comes after that sentence, disregard.
Well, can I join you in the pitchfork battle against the people who say that? Because I hate it as well.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you. I think people can get too negative here.
Yep.
And I think there's two issues here. One is the world's not going to end, okay? The world's going to enter.
I feel better. Oh, my God, thank you.
Exactly. The world's not going to end. But we're going to enter a period of low growth, of stagnation, and people forget that during the 1920s and 1930s, which were extremely difficult economic times, money was still made. People did make money.
Right.
But you've got to think about it differently. And I think I've spread out two sort of time horizons. One is a kind of a medium time horizon, and the other is a short-term volatility, and particularly the risk of a catastrophic error. Because I think the biggest factor in the market is now it's driven by policy announcements, which are completely incomprehensible to me, simply because nobody seems to know anything about what they're doing, and they keep changing their minds from one day to the next. And I think there is a chance, it's not a zero chance anyway, of a major policy miscalculation, which leads to, you know, a fairly disruptive event. But in the medium term, let's go back to exactly the point that you made. Companies are going to make money. And I think you've got to look at companies which are in industries which will do well. And frankly, what I now look for is very simple, long, stable cash flows. I forget about whether if I buy at 100, I'm going to get back 120. I'm more interested in, okay, I buy 100, I'm buying a perpetual stream of dividends. The question is, how vulnerable are those dividends? What's the rate of return on those dividends? That's the first thing I focus on. Because fundamentally, those companies which are well-positioned, which have cut their costs, which are in the right market spaces, will do okay. They won't do fantastically. But if you're looking for a buy and flick, that's more difficult. But if you're doing the buy and flick, other than inside information, which which is handy, but not legal.
Thanks, Raj.
That's right. And basically, actually, to be honest, Raj is not mine. It's not anywhere in my name. I want to assure everybody.
No, I know.
And I'm
just
from India, and I'm not from Sri Lanka, I have no idea, and I don't belong to any expert network. Any other pieces of evidence, I'll give you my mother's birth certificate. Is the next thing I'll
Oh, thanks.
But coming back, the other thing is, all these companies are building up cash. People say you need to understand how a corporate's balance sheet works. If you don't get top-line growth, which they're not getting, revenue's not growing, they don't invest, they work in capital releases, they get a huge buildup of cash, which they're going to release. And you're going to get one-off special dividends, share buybacks, which is good for you. But the other thing is that they're going to start to buy other companies, and so forth. There's going to be a lot of M&A activity, some of it good, some of it not so good. But you can take advantage of that to basically, if you position yourself correctly, to do quite well out of it, because the industries are going to consolidate. So you need to trap that income, because essentially, let's be honest, and your relativity point is very well made, interest rates are going to be very low for prolonged periods of history. I'll tell you the worst financial decision I ever made. A friend of mine runs a JGB fund, a Japanese government bond fund. Around about 96, I think it was, he said to me, you know, JGBs are 3%. Is that good or bad? I said, you know, 3% for 20 years. That doesn't seem the right sort of risk-reward ratio.
Oh, boy.
And was I wrong? I mean,
well, you could. That was impossible to predict that it's going to get to this level.
Absolutely.
I mean, but it's ridiculous.
But what it shows you, and the lesson I learned from that is looking at the past, looking at normal metrics, sometimes in abnormal times, is dangerous.
Yep.
And I think we know that Bernanke is going to keep interest rates down. The long end of the curve is also going to stay down because there's no inflation, no matter what anybody tells me.
Right.
You strip food and energy out of it, there's no inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, under those circumstances, the big game is going to be to look for return in terms of yield. And you can buy, obviously, shares with good dividend yields, but you'll also be able to pick up good corporates with good cash flows who can basically pay back that debt at reasonable returns.
Right.
So there is going to be money to be made. And this is for particular people. And most people can't trade every day of their lives and every move. It's
That's what they got me for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the next issue is that they've got to try to get some benefits out of the volatility. And sometimes strategies which capture the volatility, particularly wild swings, by buying options and so forth, might also work for you.
Yeah.
But those are the only things that you can really do. I mean, I'll give you one picture last night. I was sitting here actually watching some stuff, and the most amusing thing about that was the BTPs, which are the Italian government bonds, were spiking at the rate of 1 basis point a minute.
Yeah, well, that happened throughout the week. I mean, it was crazy what was going on. Crazy.
Oh, it was absolutely unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. And I was watching there going, this is just basically surreal in the best way I can describe it. And I said, how the hell do you trade this?
Well, let me ask you a question. Let's set this up. First of all, let's put in the backdrop of all this, that there's been discussion by many economists all over TV and media that if the rate of Italian bonds goes above 7%, that is going to be catastrophic, right? Let's put that in the background.
Yep.
And now you have an Italian bond auction, and let's pretend I'm Italy for a second, and you're a buyer. And I say, here's the deal. The deal is that right now we're having some difficulty. You know, right now we have probably the fourth largest debt in the world, and we have a debt-to-GDP problem, and we have a problem with the collection of taxes. On top of that, high unemployment and slow growth and all that. Now, on top of that, I just want to mention to you that we're really not sure about our government structure at this point. We are in between in flux of possibly our leader stepping down if we can confirm a budget that we're not exactly sure if it's going to work. Now, how many bonds do you want to buy?
Oh, I think the only buyers of Italian BTPs is going to be basically the Italian banks,
right,
who will then take the bonds, go to the European Central Bank and repo them to fund them.
Right.
And the only other buyers will be other Central European central banks.
Right. And then as a backdrop, you have that the bond vigilantes are gunning for that 7%. So they get it there. So they get it there. And then on top of that, I don't know why, really I don't know why, the ECB didn't step in to really artificially behind the scenes push this stuff down, because they're just stupid. You know, I understand it's manipulation. I understand all that. But they're just stupid. Because the fact of the matter is, by not doing the things that are required, I don't mean that by that should be manipulation, but we know that they have the money to basically be buying some sovereigns. And you know what? Even not if that's not the case, you could step in and buy some of them. And you're gonna, at the end of the day, it's all the same money right now anyway.
To some extent, you're right. But the real issue is, I think the ECB is really conflicted, because the ECB's problem effectively is that they are now almost the de facto government of Europe, because essentially the government mechanism doesn't work. And if you look at the three options that are on the table for doing anything in Europe, one is obviously Germany just assumes all this debt, and Germany and France, but they can't afford to do that. The mm-hmm. second is they allow destructive defaults, which nobody wants to see, because it would bring down the euro. And the third one is printing money. But the problem is the ECB by its charter can't print money. And also, the Germans are essentially committed not to allow the ECB to print money.
Yeah, because they're the ones that got the benefit all these years, but in the end, they're going to get the biggest screwing.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing here, which is quite amusing, is that the Germans themselves don't get it. I was in Europe about a month ago and talking to Germans. They don't actually seem to think that there's a problem, because effectively, they are doing quite well. So basically, on a personal level, they go, well, what's the problem? And then you point out to them this, and they go, oh, well, nobody's told us. And then I watched a clip of the actual parliamentary debate in Germany about the passing of the expansion of the European Financial Stability Fund. The debate was hilarious, because nobody was allowed to speak against the motion. Angela Merkel couldn't bring herself to speak in favor of the motion. But the funniest bit was when two of the parliamentarians who voted for this package were interviewed by a German television crew outside. And they asked them what they passed. They had no idea. Who was it for? They had no idea. And then the crucial question was, well, how much money did you commit? They said, oh, a billion euros, something like that. It was 211 billion euros.
Yeah.
They had no idea.
Yeah.
They had no idea what they passed.
It's
so they continue to think this is all going well.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this. I want to kind of segue, because we really haven't talked about this. I don't think we've talked about this on the show, but the whole MF Global situation. Now, let me just give everybody a little bit of a setup here. So MF Global is a 200-year-old company that has some roots in you know, some very strong futures and options and plays. And in fact, just to kind of bring you full circle here, or up to date, in 2009, I was questioning whether this place was going to stay in business. And former governor of New Jersey, former senator, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, John Carzine, comes to the rescue and says, I will be the CEO and all that. And he comes in and everybody's, oh, this is wonderful. Now, meanwhile, my history lesson of John Carzine goes back to when he made big bets on things over at Goldman and was very stubborn and wouldn't break his bets no matter really what the level of losses were in the interim. There was a time, I think, that he had 100 or 200 million at the time. It was big. $1 million loss, and the partners were just getting whacked left and right, and bonuses were getting whacked left and right. And he ended up coming out with it with a little bit of a gain, but I think there was another one that he lost over $100 million. So this is the history of this gent. Comes to MF Global and does his thing and makes an investment utilizing the funds of the firm. For a moment, I have no idea if he commingled and he used other money. So let's just say he used the funds of the firm, leveraged them about 30 times, and bought, of all things, the sovereign debt of Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland. It didn't say Greece anywhere that I saw. But okay, what is this guy thinking?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here which are fascinating. The one is just straying outside your own business competence, because MF Global, I remember them as well, because I remember them as an institutional broker of futures and options and a few other things, and they were quite competent. There was nothing wrong with them. Mm-hmm. They did that. What were they doing, thinking they could become a full-fledged investment bank and basically go and bet with shareholders' capital? That's the most interesting thing, and how the board sanctioned that, I have no idea.
Well, it's very simple. It's very simple. It's Corazon convinced him. Listen, this guy had a big ego. He had bonds on him. Well, it wasn't even bonds. It was an option that he created to pay off. The call would be, the upside call would be, if he got appointed to a presidential position of maybe economics or some other position inside the White House, that would be the option would pay off. Did you know that?
Yes, I was aware of that.
What an
ass. As you say, yeah, but how anybody can agree to that, I just, it's beyond my capacity to appreciate. But then the next issue is, I think Corazon, whatever his competences and so forth, or incompetences, but crucial thing is, he's not alone, because there is this blind faith that A, government bonds are secure, B, the Europeans are going to come in riding in on a white charger to save Italy and so forth. And I've been saying to people that when market paradigms change, when regimes shift, the one person you do not want to have making a decision is somebody who has history. It can be very dangerous, because they didn't learn the facts.
During the downslope.
Absolutely. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, during the upslope, it's great because they know what happened afterwards, and if it actually goes that direction, you're a hero.
Absolutely. And this goes to your points about P.E. ratios and so forth. You know, looking at the past is interesting sometimes, but it doesn't necessarily give you very good clues.
Right.
And I think the crucial thing here is, if you just, again, go back to the facts and do the numbers, these countries overall, if Germany was to take them over, is basically going to need about 200 billion euros a year. Now, let's assume for the moment, let's leave France out of it, because France has its own problems. You look at Germany. If you take 200 billion every year out of the German budget, remember, the German GDP is about 3 trillion. So you're taking about roughly, say, 7 or 8% of GDP and channeling it to these countries. By the way, that's about roughly 20% of annual tax revenues in Germany. So basically, you're asking the taxpayers to say, you put €100 in tax to the government, and 20 euros of that will go to your southern neighbors in the interest of saving the euro. And you sort of say that might work, provided you don't tell them about it, but it's not going to work if you tell them about it. And Corazon's bet, really, in the end, was number one, that this is economically feasible, but then it was extremely politically naive. I mean, the signs have been clear for the last 6 to 12 months. The Germans are being sort of dragged inch by inch to do something. And I think at the point, they've reached the point where they're saying, well, I don't think this is going to work. And not only that, the other countries like Finland, Netherlands, and so forth have already reached that point. And France has a different problem. I mean, France, I think, is on the verge of being downgraded.
Well, you know, you and I have talked about this. I think we've talked about it offline.
Yeah.
That's my greatest fear.
I think they're on the verge.
And I think the problem is, and they were recently said that they're going to be good, but now the problem is that when you combine the, you know, the three blind mice, five blind mice, or the entire army of blind mice running around Greece and Italy right now, and not to mention other places, I think that the problem is that now that there is no real plan, that it seems, and there is no effective government in Italy.
Andrew, you're very harsh. You're very harsh. There is a plan. There is a plan to have a plan.
Oh, but they're not going to tell us. They're not going to tell us.
No. There's a plan to have a plan, and the plan to have a plan is to have another meeting, to have another plan, and then to have a summit. And you know, basically, we're just going to go on.
These guys must have the best life.
They have the best number of frequent flyer miles,
and they have great meals and all that, and they just get it wrong, and they plan.
Andrew, have you ever wondered if you fly on presidential jets and you know chancellors' private jets? Do you think they get frequent flyer miles?
Yes, on all the airlines, actually, at the same time.
Absolutely. So they must be great. You know, you must be able to. I mean, Angela Merkel's just practicing for her holidays and for retirement when she gets booted out.
You know, actually, though, what's really kind of interesting is, you know, last batch of meetings over in Europe, they pretty much narrowed it down to a day and a half, maybe, of meetings to solve all the problems. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And I'm thinking, let me. Like, sometimes it takes me a day and a half to figure out how to, I don't know, you know, what to wear. And meanwhile, they're going to solve all the problems of their entire region. Anyway, crazy stuff. Let's just kind of, we could go on and on for hours about this. Your book, I know it's getting great reviews. I've seen you recently in the Financial Times. There was a video of you there, of course, in the Inside Job. Was you played the starring role of the handsome gentleman who obviously got all the women. You've written a book. Tell us about the book. How's it doing?
The book's doing okay. It's sold reasonably well in most parts of the world. It's up to about, I think, 22,000 copies sold globally, which for what is not Jamie Oliver's cookbook is probably quite respectable.
Right.
And look, it's one of those things. I think I wanted to do it. I wanted to put some information out there so people who are interested wanted to do it. Now, whether they like it, whether they buy it and read it, that's their decision. You can never control it. You can't control that part of the process. But I'm very gratified by the fact that most of the reception that the book has received is positive.
Well, if you've gotten a copy of that, you'll know that it is a great book by Das, and it's getting great reviews, very highly rated on Amazon, and got great reviews by all the various majors. So, you know, that's something that could be great holiday reading for you. You know, we have a lot to learn from what happened over last year, and hopefully some of the things that we haven't learned yet because we don't know about them. You know, the greatest mystery in life and the most difficult thing to figure out is the idea of, well, what we don't know, we kind of don't know. And we're not going to know about that unless we do investigation, question, research, and question some more. So the idea that we know everything that's going on and there's always going to be the similar cycles is kind of silly, because always there's going to be a little wrinkle, and we have to be aware of that. So what we're going to do next year, throughout the year, is to try to continue with education, not only of ourselves but of our audience. A lot of people have written me about some of the educational discussions that we've had. We're going to try to put up more charts and come up with some great stock ideas. We have, I think I told you, before the end of the year, we're going to have about upwards of about 10 different stock picks that we think may be worthwhile to take a look at, and we'll have them throughout the next week or so on the website, or next weeks on the website, and in the next podcast coming up at the beginning of the year. Hopefully you enjoyed the discussions that we had today with the various guests over the last year, and you know, if you have any people that you want us to interview, well, just send them on along. You could always follow me on Twitter. It's at Andrew Horowitz. And Facebook, of course. Make sure to visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com and write me anytime you want, simply at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I thank you for being there. I really want to tell you from the bottom of my heart and from all of us that are involved in creating the podcast, thank you so much for a great few years. We're going to continue on doing this as long as we can because I really enjoy it. And we really haven't missed an episode in the last, I don't know, two years or so, weekly, coming out on Sundays, sometime about 9 p.m. Eastern time each and every Sunday, sometimes a little bit earlier, sometimes a little bit later. But again, thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for your kind words and your letters, your cards, and the things that you've sent, and all the things that you do for me as well. So this is not only, you know, one side. It's obviously a conversation. So thank you so much. I'm wishing you the warmest, the best, the most wonderful end of year 2011 and a wonderful 2012 and beyond to you and your family, your loved ones, and everyone. Thank you so much. I'll see you soon next week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.